Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important and yet least understood aspects of the war for the free world is a phenomenon that is so material to its course that it's unbelievable that it has gotten as little attention as it should and as little attention as it has, except from one man, and he is our first guest, I'm pleased to say. His name is Roger Robinson. He is these days the chairman of the Prague Security Studies Institute. He also has a consulting firm in Washington, D.C., RWR Advisory Group. And he has a wealth of public service experience that bears directly on his understanding of a phenomenon that is truly chilling, which is our underwriting of the Chinese Communist Party threat posed to us and the rest of the free world, increasingly with money from American investors, many of whom are unwitting that they're actually contributing in this material way to a mortal peril to our country. To talk about all of that and some very interesting recent developments, I'm very pleased to welcome back to this microphone an old friend and valued colleague, Roger W. Robinson. Good to have you with us, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Now, you spent time, of course, on the Reagan National Security Council, helping President Reagan understand and devise an appropriate strategy for dealing with the last terrible communist threat this country faced, namely that of the Soviet Union. Indeed, I think you were instrumental to his strategy for taking it down and his success in doing just that. So this has positioned you brilliantly for the present challenge. I'm very keen to get your sense, Roger, as to why it is that so few Americans, even in the national security space, understand the insanity, really, of what we have long now been doing, both in our capital markets and through other business sector leaders, to make the Chinese Communist Party a more formidable threat.
Well, Frank, I would just quickly say that I'm speaking under the auspices of the Prague Security Studies Institute today, as you mentioned. And I think it's the fact that for 20 years or better, we have had no monitoring, screening, vetting of any kind with respect to Chinese corporate entities that were entering our capital markets and raising large-scale money there. That's quite remarkable in and of itself. We don't have a similar free lunch on the trade front. We have the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, for example. There's some effort to weed out, if you will, those national security threats, and it even applied to egregious human rights abuses. But in the case of the capital markets, frankly, I think it's the fact that the national security community is not that well-versed from a skill mix point of view in global finance. And those that are in global finance and should know better are too involved in making large-scale fees and tend to view the national security community as disruptive and a gratuitous problem, seeing that they're always seemingly in the way of making money in China. So the twain has not met, so to speak. And as a result, we have had this incredible window of vulnerability decades long, whereby not only hundreds of billions, but over $1 trillion has moved from American investors into the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party. And even today, we have in the over 1,000 Chinese companies in our markets, we have a significant number of companies in the portfolios of the American people that are sanctioned by the United States or are otherwise known to be egregious national security and human rights corporate bad actors. Now, that's the sorry tale, and it was addressed in part during the Trump administration, and I'm pleased to say that the continuity on this issue has gained ground even under the Biden administration, but it's going to be a tough road because Wall Street is absolutely dug in on this and don't seem to care about their brands or corporate reputations when it comes to trying to make money on national security and human rights corporate abusers.
This is all the more stunning, Roger, because in addition to everything you've said, the Chinese have actually had preferential access to our markets. They don't have to conform to our various statutory and regulatory requirements for transparency and accountability and governance issues that are meant to protect American investors. It's all the more outrageous that, that these are companies, in some cases, that are tied to the People's Liberation Army, or as you say, engaged in human rights abuses. Which brings me to a new development, one that I think is potentially quite momentous, and I wanted to get your take on it. The State Department, I think just yesterday, issued a warning, very direct warning at that, to both financial sector and I think other businesses in America that are working with, having supply chain relationships or otherwise tied to the Chinese region known as Xinjiang, where the Chinese Communist Party is engaged, as you of course are well aware, in egregious human rights abuses, including genocide and slave labor. Talk about this new warning from the State Department, its implications, Roger, and what it should mean for private sector entities in this country.
Well, Frank, to start, it's even somewhat better news. It's an interagency document signed off on by, for example, the Treasury Department, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, the Department of Commerce, and Homeland Security, to name a few. The Defense Department is notably absent. But otherwise, it's quite a powerful list of logos that are on the top of that so-called advisory, which you properly indicate is a stark warning. And really, I think the administration itself has to be stunned by the callousness of Wall Street in not responding to the removal of companies from indices or exchange-traded funds or other so-called passive investment vehicles where most of the American people's money is invested. They're still holding on to companies, as I say, that are on the Commerce Department entity list, that are on the Pentagon's list of communist Chinese military companies that are now even on the OFAC list from the president's recent Executive Order 14032, signed on June 3.
So now that's, of course, the Office of Foreign Asset Control of the Treasury Department, which has real teeth in its list of sanctions, no?
Yes, and those companies on the list are facing expulsion, in effect, from the U.S. capital markets within 1 year's time. And on August 2nd, you can't buy those equities or bonds anymore. You can only divest. So it's a serious set of sanctions. Thank goodness, the first of their kind in American history, started in the previous administration. So that's all in the good news category, but Wall Street's not persuaded. And I think that even the administration is finding it very embarrassing now to have their efforts seemingly ignored by Wall Street. And the most egregious offenders, including sanctioned companies, remain in the portfolios of up to 150 million Americans in this what has been a 20-year hijacking of this flow of money from Americans into the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party by Wall Street firms and individuals that care more about fees than they do our national security, investor protection, and fundamental values as a nation.
Roger, this is sort of appalling. And I think most investors who are as you say, having their resources, their savings, their pension funds, what have you, placed into companies that are directly tied, in every case, I think, to the Chinese Communist Party, even if they're so-called private sector entities. In some cases, they actually work for the military or intelligence agencies of that government. But in every case, they have to do the bidding of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. This is a perennial concern of ours that those investors' interests, their values, if you will, are being ignored. Would the effect of this warning from the various agencies of the U.S. government that you've mentioned, Roger, essentially serve notice on those managing American investors' portfolios, or putting their money into index funds or mutual funds or what have you in China that have these kinds of ties or serve essentially as enablers of some very malevolent entities and their activities, that they are at risk themselves of being found criminally liable for this kind of behavior if it does, in fact, hit the electrified fence of, if I can use that expression, genocide in China or slave labor, for example. Human rights violations of the worst kind.
Well, that's right, Frank. I mean, it's a stunning circumstance. These companies, whether they're BlackRock or Vanguard, MSCI, FTSE Russell, and others, they have to worry about their brands and corporate reputations here at long last. The administration's being very clear that these represent, in holding these companies in indices or even worse, exchange-traded funds and investment products, is a fiduciary nightmare in the making. It's malfeasant. Again, asymmetric material risk. What does that mean? It means that things don't go just kind of wrong. They can go very wrong. When you're dealing with genocide, when you're dealing with concentration camps, when you're dealing with funding ICBMs targeting American families, advanced weaponry trained on our forces, you are involved in a circumstance that can shred corporate reputations and brands like nobody's business. And I don't know why they don't wake up and smell the coffee on this, but precious few of the companies have been divested to date. I think this is going to serve as an accelerator because it's now very difficult for these companies to justify continuing to hold what we would think of as renegade, malevolent players of the worst order. And I think it's unsustainable. And I'm hoping that this, together with a legislative new Chinese corporate human rights abusers list that I hope to see making its way through the legislature in the next coming days and weeks, can, again, put the spotlight on this and make clear that the American people did not ever have in mind funding these kinds of activities directed against our country and everything we hold dear with their retirement dollars, with their investment portfolio monies. This is their money. Where does Wall Street get off taking that money and funneling it for purposes that clearly are directly undermining our democracy and, again, everything we hold dear? A parting thought, Frank, which is that all of us have stockbrokers, financial advisors, fund managers, pension plan administrators in our world. And I think the message to them needs to be loud and clear, which is just say no to any Chinese company that has any kind of remote relationship to these types of national security and human rights abuses. And if they won't, excise them from your portfolio. Tell them that you'll find somebody that will.
Roger Robinson, this is such an important, indeed, clarion call. You've worked on this subject for, well, many years, and I think have deserved as a result a lot of the credit for helping shape this policy decision-making. And that's been true under both the Trump administration and the Biden administration. I appreciate your coming aboard from time to time to expose us to what it all means and why it is so important. And I just want to emphasize, again, your bottom line, that it's our money. It mustn't be used to harm not only our own personal interests in the sense of the value of these shares and investments, but most especially not at the expense of our national security. Thank you, Roger Robinson, for the great work you do at the Prague Security Studies Institute and for joining us here today. It's great to talk with you. Talk again soon. Next up, we will speak with Susan Katz Keating with just the news about all the news that's not in the New York Times. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of our country's great investigative reporters, and that's all the more of an accolade because we are so desperately in need of good, honest investigative reporting. It is, of course, the trademark of the Just the News Network, John Solomon's outfit, and it is the hallmark both in her work there and in her reporting career to this point of Susan Katz Keating. She is these days the chief national security correspondent for Just the News and a good friend of this program. We're always delighted to have her with us. Susan, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's always fabulous to be here. I really appreciate your kind words and love chatting.
Heartfelt and deserved in this case. Let me talk to you about something you've written on recently, as we are all prayerful that what is developing in Cuba is possibly the beginning, at least, of the end of the nightmare of communism in that country. And I'd be very interested in your thoughts about what's happened so far and where you think this is likely to go from here.
Well, it's fascinating what's going on. And it's also it's both heartbreaking and heartening. And I spoke to a Cuban exile yesterday who told me that he had previously supported Castro and he was very much on board with Castro. And then he saw for himself what communism really looked like, and he turned against the regime, and he said that it's spreading like wildfire. He said that young people especially don't understand, you know, why these rules are being imposed upon them from what they can see, you know, to their detriment. Like, they don't see any point in it. And from what I'm hearing from people who have, you know, contacts inside Cuba, is that this is a very serious and growing and evolving movement, and that it's not going to go away easily.
Well, from your lips to God's ears is all I can say. The movement, such as it is, has been expressed thus far in widespread but relatively small demonstrations. And not altogether surprisingly, the Marxist regime has responded with threats and actual violence as well. To the extent that that's happening, Susan, are you hearing from your sources that there's a sense that the population more broadly is similarly now breaking with the regime? And while that's not yet manifest, it is coming.
Yes. And in fact, they are using as their theme song sort of like a hip-hop rap song that has gone viral. And it's this group of young guys who put out this song earlier this year. And it's like Country and Life in English is what it means. And it's spread. And people in Cuba are just, they're tired of this. They're actually fighting back, I'm told, with rocks and sticks at this point.
Which is all that they have to try to protect themselves against the police or these paramilitaries or presumably in due course, ultimately, perhaps even the army. These are the sorts of tools of repression, of course, that the communists have perfected over the years, both in Cuba and elsewhere. And Susan, I just pray, and I think all of us do, at least those of us who love freedom, that this uprising will not only catch fire and spread and be supported more broadly by the people of Cuba, but also achieve the ultimate objective that we've long sought, and I think many of them have as well, namely the liberation of the place. Let me ask you about one other development, and I understand that this has not gotten as much attention perhaps in your shop as well as others as it needs, but just to help burnish the point that we are in the midst, well, I call it the war for the free world. This present phase is an active struggle between the Marxists of Cuba and other places, including Peru, a country that I've come to know and admire greatly. In Peru at the moment, Susan, there is a 40,000 vote difference between a Marxist, out-and-out avowed Marxist, by the name of Pedro Castillo, and a pro-freedom, pro-capitalism, pro-Western political figure by the name of Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of a man who previously served at a time, particularly to his great credit as president of Peru. But the point here is, at the same time that people are indicating how desperate they are to shake off the shackles of communism in Cuba, we're seeing a very important country in South America perilously close, as a result, it seems, of outright fraud in the recent election, to seizing power and turning Peru into the next horrific communist totalitarian state and basket case, like Venezuela, nearby Venezuela. Any thoughts on how important these sorts of developments are in their own right, of course, to the people most immediately involved, but to a hemisphere that is, of course, tied to us at a border that is increasingly open. I just wonder what your thoughts are about the stakes here.
Well, you said the key element when you mentioned the possibility of the voting fraud, because I am very suspicious that this is a legitimate election. But the other thing is that history has shown, and we've got enough time where we've been able to see this unfold, is that Marxism just doesn't work. It never has worked, and it has not gone well for the people who are under Marxist regimes. So you have to be very suspicious as to what would cause countries to turn Marxist. And so what is the unseen hand? Like, who is behind this, and what is the destabilizing goal for these Marxist regimes and the spread of Marxism? And you can look at the usual suspects, but the end result would be it would act to destabilize the Western influence. So it's an attempt to shift, as you noted, the dynamic of world power.
Well, that's such an important point, and I think you're absolutely right. This is a case where the Cubans, of course, but the Iranians, including Hezbollah, and the Russians, and also the Chinese, are on the ground in Peru trying to have this come out to the detriment of the United States and the free world more generally, and to the benefit of its enemies. And this is a very, very ominous reason for paying attention to the problem and hopefully helping achieve a forensic audit of the kind that we're now needing clearly in swing states in this country, but that are, I think, every bit as important now in trying to help make sure that the voting was free and fair in Peru. Susan, let me quickly just take another minute with you, if I can, about a problem closer to home. And that is, well, what I consider to be the Marxist takedown of the United States military. As you know, Republicans in the Congress asked two senior military retirees to address the question of how, well, I think the term that's been used is wokeism, is now penetrating and really to the great detriment of our military's readiness and combat proficiency, sort of becoming the dominant focus of training and, you know, unit activity, the so-called diversity and all that, the social engineering of the military, I guess is how I would describe it. What are your thoughts about that and its implications for our security and for the forces required to support it?
Well, the one thing that actually gives me hope and comfort is that U.S. service members have a really strong built-in BS meter. If like, throughout the ranks, they're really good at recognizing when, you know, from on high, like, nonsense is being imposed upon them. And so like, what I'm hearing from like sailors in particular that I've been talking to and some Marines is that they're absolutely rolling their eyes at this training, and they are looking at it to sort of be a wave that passes over. And I hope they're right, because you know, you really do need to focus on the training in the national defense rather than on sort of, social attitudes of the day, which shouldn't impact the military whatsoever. That's not what they're there for. They're not there to enact a social agenda.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that, needless to say, but it does seem as though civilian authorities at the moment have in mind this not being just a temporary phenomenon, but a permanent makeover, a fundamental transformation, I think is the term that Barack Obama coined for it, of the U.S. military. And I worry, I have to tell you, that the people that are expressing the kind of sentiments that you've just described, the rolling of eyes and holding of noses, I guess, are the kinds of people who are being purged from the military under the Biden team. And that's doubly worrying, because they're the kinds of people, I think, by and large, that you very much want to have on duty when, not if, but when we next need them. So, Susan, again, your reporting on all of these issues at Just the News is so appreciated. I appreciate especially the chance to visit with you about your reporting and insights. I look forward to doing so again very soon. Come back to us, if you will, in the near future. Next up, we'll be speaking with Lance Crayon about some influence operations the Chinese are engaged in here in the United States that I think require our urgent attention as well. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Lance Crayon. He is a man with a very interesting background. He worked for a time in Beijing and subsequently in Los Angeles for several of the Chinese Communist Party's propaganda outlets, China Daily and Global Times among them. He has had, as a result, insights from, well, inside the belly of the beast about the kinds of influence operations that the Chinese Communist Party has been mounting, both in China itself and from it, including here inside the United States, and the impact that they have been having in our media, in social media, in Hollywood, our culture, and our politics and governance more generally. I'm very pleased to have him back to talk a little bit about that in the context of important development in the past day or so. Julie Su, a woman who is well known to Lance from her time as the Secretary of Labor in California, has now been confirmed on a party line vote to become the Deputy Secretary of the Federal Labor Department. We'll talk with him about what's up with that and what might flow from it. Lance Crayon, it's good to have you back with us. Welcome once again to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Give us a little bit of a sense of Julie Su's performance as Secretary of Labor in your native state now, of California. What did she do, and what I guess, didn't she do that is of note?
I think the second part of your question is really the only question. It's what did she not do when she assumed control in 2019? She was in the middle of a divorce and, I guess, distracted to begin with when COVID hit and the unemployment, California's EDD, became, obviously inundated like everyone's. It just shut down. It was just a failure, an abysmal failure, and left thousands of people without money and homeless. She did not find a solution. She kept trying to fix, or she hired people to fix a problem that remains broken. And it's taken, almost 2 years. I think that was one of the problems that they had with her nomination, why it took so long approving it.
Yeah, I'm sure that it did. How did that manifest itself, though? It was rising numbers of people on the streets of California. That's certainly been evident. Was there also a concern about funds being misspent, misallocated, fraudulently expended, those sorts of things?
It was funds being stolen. The number is close to $30 billion has been siphoned from California's unemployment financial reserves. $30 billion. Hacking groups from Africa, China, and Russia have been implicated.
So people were simply breaking into the unemployment system of California and expropriating the funds of something that evidently was taking place on a huge scale, and she did nothing to counter it?
Exactly. There were inmates, California death row inmates, who were receiving unemployment assistance. That's how bad it got. There was an audit originally called, but Gavin Newsom canceled it because it was a Republican ordered. He canceled the audit and then brought in his own people about a month later to do an audit. They recommended, how to fix this. They shut down for 2 weeks, called it a reset. And then when they reemerged, it was still broken. It's like I said earlier, it has not been fixed. Very little has been tried to remedy the situation. And Julie Hsu has also ignored, directives directly from the federal government, regarding verification checks that you're supposed to take and before you can receive money that she ignored, and she wasn't supposed to. So because it was taking too long, that allowed hackers to exploit the system, to hack in and help themselves to, like I said, almost $30 billion. She did not fix anything.
One of the other things that I think you have been concerned about, as have those of us involved with the Accountability Initiative, which is a terrific online resource at the Accountability Initiative.org, accountabilityinitiative.org. If you look there for a backgrounder on Julie Hsu, I think it was done in the late part of March, as her nomination was being considered in the Senate, her ties to the Chinese Communist Party are particularly troubling as well. Talk a little bit about those, if you would.
Sure thing. When she ran as a lawyer before she was nominated, before she became head of the Labor Department, she went after, she billed herself as someone who protected immigrant rights, workers' rights. But she, suspiciously enough, for 15 years, nearly avoided any cases that involved Chinese companies and Chinese immigrant workers. Most of the migrants she defended were from Mexico, South Korea, Thailand, elsewhere, but not China. And the few cases that she did handle, she ruled in favor of the Chinese companies, which I think is extremely strange and something that has not really been discussed or discussed enough. Chinese companies seem to be mainland Chinese companies, she wasn't a threat. She wasn't an issue.
This is only one facet of the problem. She apparently has enjoyed strong support from and been associated over the years with the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, APALA, as it's called. What can you tell us about this outfit and what kind of tell is her connection to it as to her ties that may be quite problematic in a Deputy Secretary of Labor, especially under a guy by the name of Marty Walsh, who's the secretary, who actually raised the flag of the People's Republic of China outside the mayor's office in Boston when he was in that position. This sounds like a 1-2 punch of very considerable concern.
Julie was associated with that, with the alliances, you know, going back to the 90s when she was fresh out of Harvard Law School. She's been in bed with him for 20 years. I mean, she started her career with this alliance. And again, going back to what I said earlier, Chinese companies here in California are ignored. In other words, they're protected. And other foreign-owned operations seem to have a lot to worry about, have to follow the laws of California, the laws of America, but not Chinese companies. And here's a strange connection. BYD, a Chinese automaker here in California, also happened to be the same company that Gavin Newsom purchased $1 billion worth of face masks quietly last year. Not only do they manufacture electric cars, ironically enough, they manufacture face masks.
Well, these connections are interesting. The point that I think really behooves us to attend to what extent will people who have these sorts of ties or predilections, shall we say, at least, in senior positions in the Biden administration actually be compromised to the point where they're more likely to be doing the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party than, you know, what's in the best interest of the United States. And as the Accountability Initiative profiles make clear, there's enough of these sorts of people in prominent positions throughout the United States government at the moment that this very reasonable concern is made all the more worrying, and it seems to me it should be actionable as well. Hey, let me turn to a different subject with you. This concerns Chinese influence operations, yes, but in countries that are near the United States that have an ability, if they submit to China, its Belt and Road Initiative or its diplomatic or political warfare or subversion, could become quite problematic to the United States. If you would, Lance Cran, talk a little bit about countries like Cuba and other islands in the Caribbean or the Atlantic adjacent to it that are now being focused on for one or the other of these kinds of influence operations by the Chinese Communist Party. I'm thinking including, you know, the targeting of those that are still supporting the sovereign nation of Taiwan.
Strategically, the location is ideal. Cuba, the Caribbean, Jamaica. So for China to set up shop with the Belt and Road Initiative, especially, that would give them a strategic stronghold as close to America as they could on foreign soil. So that's the goal that they've been working on since 2015. Starting with Cuba, Cuba being a communist country, obviously that's been an ally of China for years. So they've focused on Cuba's position. That is their, you know, that is why it's so desirable compared to the other Caribbean islands that they've been working on trying to infiltrate since 2015, Jamaica, Dominican Republic, and now Haiti. It's twofold. One, the position, obviously, but there are actually mineral reserves there that China wants and needs and could exploit.
When you say foothold, I think we ought to be clear about some of the aspects of this. It's in many cases, notably in the Bahamas, two different areas of the Bahamas, I believe, and in Jamaica, and I think in the Dominican Republic, there has been infrastructure building going on with the Chinese debt trap financing in some cases, certainly their construction operations, or certainly, if not the others, to their benefit. And what I'm concerned about, Lance, as we are talking about this, we're watching these countries become not only susceptible to considerable pressure from the Chinese Communist Party, but quite possibly become points from which the Chinese may project power in the future. There's a port, for example, in the Bahamas, as I understand it, that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a commercial point of view, but is well-positioned in proximity to the United States to posing real threats to us if the Chinese do militarize it, as we've seen them do in other places around the world. How great a concern should that be to Americans? This is more than just influence operations.
It should be of utmost concern, because no other country has done that. No other country has set up militarily strongholds in those countries, in the Caribbean, in the Bahamas. So it'll be a first for an enemy to be that close and to have a military support. So, and yeah, it would be a first, and it's quite scary. That is the number one goal with China, is getting that up and running. And how they entice countries is, first you kick Taiwan out of your country, and then we give you money. And that's what they started doing with Jamaica in 2015. That's what they did with Dominican Republic beginning in 2018. That's what they want to do now with Haiti. They've been trying to do with Haiti for 3 years.
You say it's unprecedented, but actually there is a precedent. We had President Reagan back in his tenure actually send military force to prevent an island that is strategically positioned off our coast, Grenada, to prevent it from falling into Soviet hands, and the use of an airfield there that might have been quite a threat to us had it been used by long-range Soviet bombers. So this requires, again, the closest of attention, it seems to me. Lance, very quickly, and lastly, one other country that has been seemingly of interest to the Chinese, presumably in part for these strategic reasons, but also perhaps because it is one of the nations in the world, diminishing number, that is still maintaining diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Talk about Haiti and what's just gone on there, and does there seem to be a connection to Chinese interests, do you think? We're all still trying to make sense of what's gone down with the assassination of President Moise, but what's your sense of what's afoot there?
Yeah, my sense is definitely that. The president who was assassinated on July 7th, had maintained diplomatic relations with Taiwan. While in the background, China had made certain pledges, upwards of $30 billion in assistance beginning in 2016, 2017, if they were willing to sever ties with Taiwan. He wasn't willing to do that, even though they had promised upwards of $3 billion in infrastructure and assistance if they were willing to sever ties with Taiwan, which is what their neighbor, Dominican Republic, had done beginning in 2018. Haiti wasn't willing to do that. So China kept angling and promising different benefits until it happened. So I think that was the goal. I think that was the motive more than anything. The U.S. has been dragging it.
A motive for the actual assassination, or simply the motive for the Chinese to be involved in Haiti and anxious to bring it into their sphere of influence?
The assassination, with new leaders in place, you'll see what's going to happen rather soon. I think China will move in.
This is a fascinating point, Lance. We're out of time, and we'll need more details on all of this, but I appreciate you calling our attention to the possibility that China's ambitions and influence operations may actually have extended to the point of murdering the Haitian president in order to advance their agenda. We'll be following that closely, and I know you will as well. Thank you for taking the time to join us today. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The State Department has just issued a much-needed warning to Wall Street and other corporate enablers of the Chinese Communist Party. It served notice that those involved in supply chains or other business dealings in Western China are, quote, highly likely, unquote, to be violating U.S. law. That's because the Chinese Communists are engaged there in such crimes as genocide, forced organ harvesting, serial rape, persecution of religious minorities, and slave labor. For these reasons, and its myriad other crimes elsewhere, the Chinese Communist Party should be designated and punished as a transnational criminal organization. In the meantime, U.S. financiers and capitalists are now squarely on notice. Many are not only engaged in risky business that may result in serious losses for their clients and shareholders, as well as harm to the national security, it may render them accomplices to the CCP's criminal conduct. This is Frank Gaffney. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.